It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many houses in Wisconsin have a history, going way back before their current owners moved in, and with a little work, you can learn the story of your home. We talk with an expert about hunting for house history. First, as the saying goes, nothing in life is certain except for death and taxes. And with the deadline to file your taxes just days away, we wanted to talk about just that, your federal taxes. Love them or hate them, taxes are a part of life. But knowing how your tax dollars are allocated, and perhaps more importantly, what decisions led to that allocation, can be a bit of a mystery. Our next guest is here to talk about how the government spends your taxes in the federal budget. And we'll also take your calls about where you'd choose to send your tax dollars if you had a choice. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Vanessa Williamson is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She's also the author of Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Vanessa, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get started, there have been quite a few stories from people this year about their taxes being higher than normal, which usually means that their refunds are smaller than usual, or they've had to pay when in the past they haven't. Is that accurate?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed bag. So the changes that happened under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, a small percentage of people will have seen actual tax increases, but there were a series of sort of mishaps that occurred early in the tax season that made some people's refunds smaller than usual. Now, those refunds were often smaller because they had had less withheld during the year. That is to say, their withholding was more accurate. But if you were expecting the same refund that you got last year and you didn't really notice that you had a few extra bucks each month, that could have come as a bit of a shock.
Taxes are always kind of a boogeyman for a lot of people, including lawmakers. Why do taxes get such a bad rap?
Well, I think taxes are a way of thinking about how happy you are with your government. So to the extent that you're unhappy with your government, you're unhappy with your taxes. And so when people are frustrated with U.S. government, state government, local government, whatever it is, I think they tend to express a lot of concern about the money that they're sending, right? Because the dollars you pay in taxes are your contribution to what should be the public good as decided by a democratic process. And when it doesn't live up to that ideal, people get frustrated.
So we send in our taxes either because they're withheld during the year or because we write a check at the end of the year. And there's a federal budget that is passed and approved and enacted. How do those two come together? How do tax dollars pay for budget items and how is that decided?
Right. Well, there are some programs that are preordained, right, that we've basically already agreed to spend on. Social Security and Medicare being two of the obvious examples. People have already been paying into those programs. A promise was made to those people. They should get the benefits that they're expecting at the end. So that's part of the budget. Other part of the budget that is decided by Congress is all the other things that we spend a lot of money on, including a fair amount of healthcare spending, but also, national defense and housing and some money going to education and the national parks and all the other things. There are a lot of moving pieces, but I can provide a quick summary of where the money goes, if that helps. It's relatively easy to remember. A quarter of the money in the federal budget goes to Social Security. A quarter of the money in the federal budget goes to Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, and ACA, so all health care expenses. About 16% of the budget goes to defense and international security, and then a little less than 10% of the budget goes to safety net programs. So that's your earned income tax credits, your child tax credit, cash payments for low-income people, supplemental security income for disabled people, SNAP, so what's commonly called food stamps, and then the last sort of piece that stands alone is interest on the debt, right? Because we're spending more than we're taking in. So those are sort of the big chunks. The last fifth of the budget is split amongst a whole bunch of things, but a lot of those things are actually really popular. So infrastructure, care for veterans, investing in education, science, and medical research. But that's a pretty small chunk compared to the big pieces.
We're talking with Vanessa Williamson right now. She's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She's the author of Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. We talked with her about that when the book came out. And today we're talking about where our federal tax dollars go. And we're asking you where you would like them to go or not to go to if you had a choice. And you can call in at 800-642-1234 and let us know. And so you broke that down, and as you said, it does turn into, you know, fairly identifiable pieces of pie of the budget and of taxes. I think for some people, there are some surprises in there. For instance, one of the things that's also kind of a boogeyman, especially for conservatives, is the amount that's spent on foreign aid. And that is non-military money that's spent in other countries. But that is an extremely small amount of the budget. I believe it's 0.7% of 1%.
That's right. Less than 1% of the budget goes to humanitarian aid. One reason I think that people tend to overestimate it is because they lump it in with a lot of military spending, right? So a lot of our foreign aid goes to places like Afghanistan and Iraq. Now we're spending very little money is actually on humanitarian aid. A whole lot is spent on the war efforts that are over there. So I think that can leave people a little confused about what really qualifies as foreign aid.
I wanted to also go back to something you said, Vanessa, because there's defense spending, but actually Veterans Affairs is separate from that.
That's exactly right. And I think that, you know, sometimes when we're thinking about, whether a military engagement is a good idea, we forget that the long-term costs, I mean, the war itself is, of course, extremely expensive and costly, of course, in lives. But we also forget that the folks coming home from those wars need to be looked after. And I know that overwhelmingly Americans agree that those are expenses worth taking on, but they do add up. And so, yes, veteran spending is a large part of the budget.
And there are kind of two sides to that coin, because if someone is concerned that not enough is being spent on defense, they might not realize that a large defense budget doesn't necessarily trickle down to, as you said, those veterans who have already served. Conversely, someone who would like to see more go to veterans might not be eyeing that in the budget because they think it's included in what they might see as a very large defense budget.
Yeah, when you look at American attitudes about defense spending, when you break it down into smaller categories, attitudes become a lot clearer because, as a rule, spending on foreign military engagements is pretty unpopular, but spending on service members themselves, both while in service and afterwards as veterans, is very, very popular. And so similarly, there's a lot of concern about, military contracting, quite reasonably, about military contracting having huge cost overruns and producing, you know, planes that the Pentagon doesn't even want, is sort of the classic example. And those things are not viewed very positively, but that doesn't affect at all whether people think that, you know, someone serving in the Army and their family should have health insurance. Of course, they think they should have health care.
How do tax priorities break down along political lines, usually among the members of the public, for instance, when they're polled?
So this is a great question. And one of the important things to remember is that not all taxes are federal taxes. So there's a whole array of things about which there is very little partisan disagreement. And those are taxes that are spent locally. So I conducted some surveys where I asked people two questions, both open-ended, and just recorded all of the things they said. One, what are you glad tax dollars pay for? Two, what are you upset tax dollars pay for? And I measure those on two axes. First, I looked at whether programs were popular, how many people put something in glad versus upset. And then I measured how often it was mentioned at all, right? Yeah. And so at the very top, the most popular programs at varying levels of salience or people's awareness of them were local spending. So that's roads, schools, hospitals, parks, all those sorts of physical things you can see in your neighborhood. And, you know, roads and school is like 30% of people remembered to mention. A pretty small percentage of people mention sewers, but anyone who does thinks it's a good idea. You know? So there's actually a whole category in which there's very little partisan divide. Where you see partisan divides primarily are health care, obviously, because that's been a partisan issue in Washington for decades, but especially recently, and secondarily spending on the poor. There's a lot more concern on the Republican side that undeserving people are benefiting, and there's more of a sense on the Democratic side that those investments are important to keep all Americans above a certain threshold of poverty.
It seemed also that there might be a difference in how important people thought that defense spending was. It wasn't that liberals thought it wasn't important at all, and Republicans or conservatives thought it was the most important thing, but there's often a difference there.
That's exactly right. And I think it's one of the things that you'll find a lot more consensus across parties if you break it down into narrower categories, right? So there's huge consensus on ensuring that service members and their families have all the things that they need. That is a bipartisan view of the American public, right? Now, when it comes to things like whether to go to war in Iraq, obviously there you start to see a huge partisan divide.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Gary in Fitchburg is up first. Hi, Gary.
Hi. It's interesting to hear such a dominant part of the discussion on defense spending, and I applaud that. I think we have 30-some thousand troops in Korea border. We have probably 38,000 troops in Germany. If we add all these up, let's bring these troops home, put them to work on high-speed trains. That would create a lot of jobs, and it would eliminate a lot of poverty. Roads, bridges, improve education. Let's put money to work here and stop this military adventurism around the world.
Thanks for that call, Gary. And Vanessa, does that echo some things that you've heard from people that you've spoken to?
Definitely. I think that, because we are now, many, many, many years, soon to be many decades into a conflict in Afghanistan, there has been a really strong sense, and then, of course, the war in Iraq thereafter, there has been a really strong sense in the public that, that this shouldn't be a sustainable long-term sort of investment. Instead, we should invest more at home. It's a very common sentiment.
Vanessa Williamson is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She's with us to talk about where our federal tax dollars go ahead of the tax deadline of April 15th. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about where your federal taxes go? If you had a say, how would you want your taxes spent? And on the flip side, where do you not want your taxes to go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to the phones and pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we continue our conversation about federal taxes ahead of the tax deadline on Monday. Our guest, Vanessa Williamson, is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about where your tax dollars go? If you don't mind paying your taxes, tell us why. If not, tell us why you don't and what you'd like to see change. And we're taking your calls about where you'd like to see your tax dollars go. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Vanessa, let's go back to our callers right now, and let's go to Eric in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Hey, great show. I think it's really germane and I think it probably has a lot of interest. I know I really don't mind paying taxes, especially in America, because we're so cheap compared to the rest of the civilized world. The thing the question that I have basically is, in your analysis, have you broken down tax expenditures on sort of a investment versus an expense delineation, meaning, those things that just cost us money because we have to pay it, like, debt service or military weapons that are never going to get used or that sort of thing, versus things that will generate income and jobs and future growth for the nation, like infrastructure and education. And one specific close to my heart is basic scientific research. I know that's way down. And then a secondary question is, have you assessed in your analysis of tax expenditures accountability around those expenditures? In other words, like, for instance, DOD and the various branches of the military haven't really had a verifiable audited budget for decades now. And it's an ongoing process. And there are these massive cost overrun projects that people don't even know about. I think, for instance, that really affect not only the amount that we're paying for basic services that we need, but that also are indicate a level of corruption and lack of accountability.
I'm going to jump in there, Eric, because I want to give Vanessa a chance to respond. Lots to go there. One of the things that Eric talked about was really interesting, things that are payments that we don't see any result from, as he said, like debt service versus investments. And he talks specifically about infrastructure and basic scientific research. Is there any sense? I'm sure that's a hard thing to tease out, but do you have a sense, Vanessa, where we might stand on those?
Sure. So about 2% of the federal budget goes to science and medical research. And of course, America for a very long time has been at the forefront of medical research. And I think the caller is exactly right to say that basic research over the long term has enormous implications for the health of our economy and the health of our people, right? So, everything from developing the idea of the internet, right? Can we even imagine a modern economy without it? A lot of that was spent via basic research. Spending, sometimes defense spending, but also all the medical and scientific spending is terribly important for those long-term investments. I think that more broadly, the caller's point is really important that we need to think about the budget in terms of making priorities, right? So if you imagine, for instance, so we spend, let's say, 16% of the budget in 2016 on defense and international security, that's about $600 billion, that's approximately how much we spend on Medicare. And Medicare provides health insurance for 57 million people. So when we're thinking about what we want to spend money on, we've got to understand that we're making a choice, right? And I think that, the federal government can and has for a very long time run a deficit. That is because the American government can print money and also, because we can have bonds that then, create sort of wealth in the private economy. The question, though, are the investments we're making with that money good investments? And I think there's real variation in the return that we see.
Let's go back to the phones, and Elaine in Colfax is up. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I had an idea that there should be a minimum wage for Social Security recipients, and I was thinking $1,000 a month would be fair and give some dignity to the elderly in this country, the richest country in the world, and the money could be raised by raising the Social Security. I think it's at $126,000. After that, they don't pay any more in. That could be raised. That would raise money. And it also would infuse rural areas with cash, to stores or buying pennies or whatever. Elderly people are really strapped. And also, I think it would help urban areas where people work very, very hard, but they have a very, very small Social Security check, and their savings can go really quick if there's any kind of medical or car problem or whatever.
Thanks for that call, Elaine. And that seems to be in line with what you were saying, Vanessa, that people like to pay for things that are kind of close to home and very concrete results.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It is certainly the case that directing funds in whatever way to low-income people has an enormous and immediate economic boon because they'll spend the money.
Go ahead. Please finish.
The advantage of providing dollars to people at the lower end of the income spectrum is that that money will immediately be recycled back into the economy because they're not going to sit on the money. They're going to go out and pay for the rent and buy the medications they need and that sort of thing. So it's absolutely true that providing basic benefits to people who are really at the edge and struggling to get by has enormous economic gains.
We're talking with Vanessa Williamson of the Brookings Institution about where our federal tax dollars go and asking where you would like to see them go. And Vanessa, I want to go back to a point that a previous caller made, and I forgot to stop when he said it. He talked about how we don't pay that much in taxes in the U.S., and that is not a very commonly held belief. How do we compare to other countries?
Yes, that is, I'm afraid, absolutely true, despite all the aggravation that we all experience when we file our federal income taxes. That doesn't actually make our government especially large. By international standards, the United States is a relatively low-tax country. That is to say that the amount of our GDP that goes through our federal government is relatively small. It's about 21%. Other countries have far more of their GDP that sort of cycles through the public sector. And largely that's because most countries provide some version of universal health care. So because we don't do that, we have lower tax rates. We do spend an awful lot on defense compared to other countries. But because there's a more robust social safety net, both healthcare and pensions, that kind of thing, in most of Europe and in Australia and Canada, that kind of thing, we tend to have a much, we do traditionally have a much lower percentage of our GDP going into the government.
Marcus and Madison said that the debt is getting out of hand. Way too much money is also being spent on the military. And Vanessa, if I remember correctly, is it 7% of the federal budget goes to just pay interest on the federal debt?
Yeah, that's about right. Obviously, it varies slightly from year to year, but that's a good number to keep in mind. The reality, in my opinion, it would be worthwhile to accrue debt that is going to result in benefits later. Right. So if you invest in something in the same way that if you invest in an education, that's going to be, get you a great job. Right. It's worthwhile to do that. I think it's worthwhile for the country to invest, even if it means putting more bonds into the economy. If it means that if it were invested in things that were going to substantially improve living standards in the United States or grow the economy or you know, sort of achieve ends that Americans think of as important, right? So I think that one of the challenges we face is that we don't raise as much money as other countries, and we're spending it in ways that are actually not always terribly popular.
Darlene on Facebook wrote, where I don't want my taxes to go includes corporate oil welfare subsidies, the war industry, aid to foreign governments to prop up their oppressive and aggressive military regimes. Where I'd like most of my taxes to go includes health care, food programs, disaster relief, housing, education, and infrastructure. And also caller Mary in Milwaukee said there needs to be more money going towards research and services towards mental health issues. So it seems like there's quite a disconnect between what our representatives in Congress and whoever's in the White House are putting forward in these budgets compared to what people seem to really care about.
That's exactly right. There are enormous differentials in that regard. In fact, particularly on the question of a category I put together is corporate bailouts, which sounded like your first respondent there was talking about. It is a subject that when I was asking those questions, what are you glad tax dollars pay for? What are you upset tax dollars pay for? No one ever mentions the money that corporations get in terms of, you know, special tax deals or bailouts in the past. No one ever mentions those positively. They are only ever mentioned by people who dislike them. So, yes, there are definitely disconnects between how the government spends and the sort of priorities of American voters.
Well, Vanessa, thanks so much for joining us. It was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Vanessa Williamson is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She joined us today to talk about taxes, namely where your federal tax dollars go. And we asked what you'd like the government to spend your taxes on if you had the choice. You can continue the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you live in a house that has had previous owners, it might have decades of history, maybe even a century or more. And we want to hear your stories at 800-642-1234. Have you found some clues about the life of your house, either by your own research or maybe accidentally? Does a photo you found of the house or your garden that has an odd feature, like an old garbage pile or a pump? What clues have helped you find out more? And what questions do you have about researching your home's history? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joe DeRose has been the Wisconsin Historical Society's survey historian for more than 25 years. He's also a member of WHS's Speakers Bureau and gives presentations on many topics, including how to research buildings. He joined us on Central Time to talk home history before, and he's once again joining us in the studio. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you, Judith.
Many people have become interested in genealogy and family history over the last few decades. Have you also seen a growing interest in home history as well?
Yeah, they kind of go hand in hand. People are always interested in learning about their ancestors. Well, those folks had to live somewhere. They had to work somewhere. And people are starting to make the connection that that type of information is out there. The Wisconsin Historical Society, our website is wisconsinhistory.org. We have what's known as an architecture history inventory, where we have information on over 150,000 buildings around the state of Wisconsin. And when people are knocking around online researching their family trees, They also come into our site and they can find out about their house.
So these are not just, say, public buildings. These are also private residences.
Correct. The vast majority of them are private residences.
And how does that information come to the Historical Society? How was it gathered there?
It's come in through a variety of purposes. My office, which is the Historic Preservation Office, has been around since the mid-1970s, and our charge is to gather information on historic resources in the state of Wisconsin. A lot of the information comes in through grants that my office gives out to communities to undertake this type of research, but it also comes in from state and federal agencies that are doing projects that impact historic resources. They're required by state or federal law to provide us with that information. And private property owners can also give us information.
So this is a little bit like playing detective, but the clues aren't probably going to just fall into our laps. What kind of expectations should we approach this kind of research with?
Well, there's a couple of expectations. First of all, the information's not going to be in one spot. You're going to have to piece it together. You're absolutely right that you are kind of a detective. The other thing is prepare to be underwhelmed by what you find. Everybody thinks that somebody famous will have lived in their home, but every building does have a story to tell, and those are the stories that I find fascinating. And every now and then you do find something that's really spectacular.
Well, let's talk about some of the cool stories you've heard, either that you've helped people find out about their homes or that they've shared with you. Are there some that stand out in your memory?
Oh, certainly. One of the projects that we're just finishing up with is identifying African-American resources in the city of Milwaukee, ones that have played a prominent role in that history. And one of the properties that we're dealing with, it had this fantastic history. So we dove right in to authenticate it. Well, it turned out that things got kind of lost through the years and kind of cobbled together with the history of other buildings. And it was actually a very satisfying project because we were able to set the record straight. But that was one of my favorite projects because the truth came out about the resource.
So it has certainly happened frequently that people do, especially the genetics testing, kind of genealogy, and find out things that maybe they wish they hadn't found out. Have you found any of that with researching buildings?
Yeah. A lot of times people hear, a lot of times we'll hear stories about, oh, this house, because it had a secret room, if you will, in the basement, that, oh, it must have been a stop on the Underground Railroad or something like that. And I got to be very gentle when I inform them that the Underground Railroad was in the mid-19th century and their house wasn't constructed until the 1920s or something.
Right.
So it's probably a coal chute or something down there that what they're dealing with.
Joe is referring to the secret room in the basement because I have one, but I did not think it was part of the Underground Railroad, just for the record. I did hope it was part of Prohibition, but then it turned out my house was too new for
that. That's my second favorite story. Everybody has a Prohibition story with their property.
I quickly realized that was not the case. But I was also thinking, you know, they might find out that something bad happened in the house as well.
Yeah, I get a lot of requests from people, especially around Halloween. They want to find out, did murders happen? I didn't know so many people were
hoping for a murder
in their home. Luckily, that doesn't happen too terribly often. But
we're talking about the history of your home, and we're taking your questions on how to research it at 800-642-1234. Have you learned something interesting about the past of your home? What do you find interesting about building history? And do you have questions about how to research your house or a local building? Or maybe you have resources to share? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Now, of course, as you said, there are great resources at the Historical Society. There are other types of resources. But if we start, pun intended, close to home, are there things that we can figure out just by taking a closer look at our house?
Certainly. There's an excellent architecture book out there called Field Guide to American Houses by Virginia McAllister. It's available online or at bookstores. And what I really like about that book is it's different than a coffee table book. We've all seen the real fancy architecture mm-hmm. books that have one-of-a-kind buildings in them. In this Field Guide to American Houses, it shows the common buildings that you're typically going to find in a community, and it has lots of pictures. So you can go, what's that dude at? Oh, there's a picture of it. And that was popular between 1880 and 1900. Architecture is like fashion. It's like music. It has styles that come into vogue and then leave. And when you learn the clues of these various architectural styles, you can pinpoint the when a building was constructed within a 30 or 40 year period. I mean, it's pretty broad, but it's a starting point.
I love that it's a field guide, like for birds or
certainly
for mammals, that you and that is a lot like what makes sense here. If it looks like an extremely rare bird and an extremely common bird, it's probably the common bird. So
yeah.
let's talk about what some of the resources are that are available. Building permits or tax records can also provide some pieces to the story.
Sure. Building permits are probably one of your best sources of information because they're going to tell you when a property was constructed, who it was built for, how much it cost, who the contractors were. It's kind of the mother load of information. The downside is building permits are a relatively modern phenomenon. Even in Milwaukee, they don't start up until the 1880s, 1890s. In Madison, sort of the same way. So you get in the smaller towns in Wisconsin, you don't have building permits until after World War II. So while they have a great amount of information, it's kind of sparse where you can find it.
Well, and you just mentioned rural areas. Are there other challenges that because maybe there are just, you know, fewer buildings, maybe there wasn't kind of as systematic an approach to cataloging?
Sure. It's more difficult there because your best source of information short of a building permit is going to be a tax record. We've always been taxed for the value of our property, and a building is going to have more value than a vacant parcel of land. And that's always held true. But it's hard with rural properties because you don't know if a house is being constructed or a dairy barn or chicken coop. You know, all of these things lend value to a property. That's where that knowledge of your architectural styles can come in handy.
Let's go to the phones, and Nancy in Grafton is up. Hi, Nancy.
Well, hello. I live here in Grafton, and I'm north of Highway 60. Well, years ago, this house that I live in was the first St. Paul's Lutheran School. And I guess the teacher lived on one floor and the kids went to school on the other floor, and there's all wood floors and they're still here. And I'm thinking, you know, that's they went to this schoolhouse, which was south of Highway 60, across the farmlands and put it on the stone foundation. And then this was the farmhouse for all the land that was around it, you know. And then years and years and years later, then this Catholic family with 14 kids, that was my family, my kids, my husband, me, my kids. And then we lived in this house, and I'm still here in this house, and I'm looking at the floor, and sometimes I think, you know, those wood floors, those little kids, whoever lived, walked on these floors and went to school here, they're probably all gone by now. But it's an old, old house, but it was a good home for us, and I'm still here.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that, Nancy. Is that the kind of really great stories that you get to hear, Joe?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Every building has a story to tell. I'm always like to hear when people know where a building was moved from and they know that story because, boy, once a building gets moved, it's really hard to research. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has that type of information, it's important to document it so we know where this property came from.
Let's go back to the phones, and Chris in Adams is up. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have a friend who bought a house in Milwaukee, and the house is on the National Registry of Historic Places. He knew that when he bought it, but he didn't know the whole history of the house. And he found a pile of very interesting paperwork in the basement. It turns out that the woman who owned this house through sort of the beginning to mid-20th century was a very famous internationally known psychic. And Harry Houdini and Liberace used to go to seances in this house.
Wow. And how did you find that out?
He found a box of paperwork in the basement that he has actual papers that were from like posters that were printed up or something. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen the paperwork, so then he went and asked around, and sure enough.
Wow. Well, thanks for that call, Chris. And Joe, I mean, there are, I mean, amazing things happen in every community all the time, and there are buildings that are associated with them.
Sure. That's the type of information that you won't know just by looking at it. A lot of buildings in Milwaukee, they all look the same on a city block, and it's the stories that separate them. You know, that information that the person is referring to, copies of that would be great at a research facility such as Wisconsin has what are known as area research centers. They're kind of satellites, if you will, of mm-hmm. the Wisconsin Historical Society of Archives. But it'd be great to get a copy of that information at that facility so that we know that story and where to attach it to.
Well, there you go, Chris. Make sure your friend doesn't just get rid of that. At the very least, scan it. And Joe, speaking of scanning, I wonder, how do you expect this process to be different in the future? I mean, obviously, you know, the internet has changed a whole lot for people researching things, but there's still things being found in basements mm-hmm. and things like that. As people become more and more digitally focused, is that going to affect us one way or the other?
Well, it helps what my office tries to do, which is collect this type of information. It's so easy. You mentioned it to scan something. You know, you don't have to send me the originals so that we mm-hmm. know of it. We can have a scanned document of it, and that makes researching so much nicer. The pitfalls, if you will, though, is people feel like they should be able to find everything online, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, we're not quite there yet. We're getting there. But there's still a lot of information that's still out there.
Well, a lot of old information and the new information being generated every day. As we wrap up, Joe, are the houses of today or the last 10 or 20 years, are they going to be as interesting to research in 50 or 100 years?
Yeah, I always get a question when I tell people that we're interested in the history of ranch houses, things that were built in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And it's hard for people to wrap their brain around something that they grew up in, something that was built by their parents or they built. Why is this important? It's important to realize, though, that, you know, ranch houses, they have a certain look to them. You know, when they were built in the 50s, they had two bedrooms, one bath with a single car garage. Fast forward to today, that type of resource isn't going to work for a lot of people. So you start, they add another garage, another bedroom, another bathroom, and we start losing these original resources. So it's important to document the ones that are still like they were when they built so that we have examples of them to preserve for the future.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for coming in. It's always fun to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
Joe DeRose has been the survey historian for the Wisconsin Historical Society for more than 25 years. He's also a member of WHS's Speakers Bureau and gives presentations on many topics, including how to research buildings. UW-Stevens Point is backing away from a plan that would have eliminated six of its academic programs, primarily in the liberal arts. The planned cuts were announced last year and went through a couple of revisions before being officially taken off the table yesterday. Stevens Point administrators did say that the school would still be streamlining programs and combining certain majors to save costs in the future. Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
So, Rich, why did UW-Stevens Point say that they're backing off the plan to cut those majors?
So there was a press release that went out yesterday that said there was a combination of factors that led to this decision. Basically, it was a combination of retirements and resignations of staff and faculty, but also it was part of this long, year-long process where administrators were meeting with faculty, staff, and shared governance groups to try to figure out how to streamline the campus to address this budget deficit that was to the tune of around $4.5 million as of last fall.
And when we first heard about the proposed cuts, there were 13 majors that were at risk, and then it was scaled back from that original idea, and the plan was to eliminate six liberal arts majors. And so where did they get to from 13 to 6 to now saying we don't need this? Is it really all resignations and retirements?
Well, according to the university, there's been, since 2014, between 2014 and 2018, there were 89 full-time equivalent positions that were reduced, and they said that was mainly through attrition. And Chancellor Bernie Patterson told me yesterday that they saw another 44 positions within that 80 figure, 40 positions, they're about reduced, and that kind of gives them a picture of $3.5 million in savings. So it's been a real roller coaster ride for the campus. But yeah, at first they mentioned 13 programs, and they scaled it back in November. The initial announcement was in March, met some criticism. They scaled it back in November, and then now we're where we are.
We're talking with Rich Kramer. He's a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Eau Claire, and we're talking about UW-Stevens Point deciding not to cut several liberal arts majors. And, Rich, I read a quote from a remaining faculty member in one of those departments, and he said, you know, basically, it's great that our major is not getting cut, but we now have half of the faculty to teach these students. Is that similar to what you were hearing from other educators there?
Well, I'm still working on trying to get the picture of how the campus, you know, community as far as faculty and staff feel about it. But yeah, that's definitely a concern. I mean, we're seeing this at campuses all over the place. Stevens Point just sort of stole the attention last year because of the large number of majors that were proposed to be cut initially. But yeah, I mean, the sense is that they're being forced to do more with less. And you know, there's always the question of whether that will impact the quality that students see or the availability of certain programs, and whether or not students will have to prolong their career at the campuses because certain things aren't offered at certain times. But I'm still trying to get a sense of how people feel in Stevens Point about it.
It sounds like another part of this plan for regaining sustainability, because, you know, those initial cuts are not necessarily going to be enough going forward, is that they're also going to combine some programs. What are they talking about combining?
Yeah, part of the plan that was announced yesterday there were three bachelor degrees in fine art that were on the chopping block, and then those are going to be merged into two new degree programs known as graphic design and integrative studio practice. Those are going to be part of a new school of design. Geography and geoscience are also going to be merged into geospatial science, a new program for the campus. And history is going to be retained, but the campus is also trying to look at ways to offer non-teaching options, ways that students that are likely to be graduating soon can kind of find different ways to integrate historical research into their profession. So it's kind of part of this process that we're hearing a lot about, you know, becoming more responsive to the needs of the workforce in central Wisconsin. But, you know, that's happening on every campus.
Well, and Rich, that you just mentioned that being responsive to the needs for a workforce, and one of the reasons given that 13 months ago when they announced the original proposed cuts was that they really wanted to focus on more business and tech kind of jobs. Are they still going to be expanding those programs while keeping these others?
Well, that's kind of the, you know, I haven't heard any specifics. I mean, the UW System Board of Regents came out and they said that there's going to be some new programs offered at Stevens Point branch campuses in Wausau and Marshfield. Those include, applied finance, health sciences, information science, social work. So they are expanding some programs. It doesn't seem like it's all geared specifically toward technical sort of things as far as trades, but, you know, the idea is that because of this general trend that we're seeing of declining enrollment at UW campuses, the campuses have to figure out how to be, you know, how to kind of cater and make more available programs in high degree fields.
And we'll have to leave it there, Rich. Thanks for joining us. Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Eau Claire. He brought us up to speed on the new decision by UW Stevens Point to back off from its plan to cut several majors in the liberal arts. It's the end of an era as UW-Madison Bands Director Mike LaCrone retires this spring after leading Badger Bands for half a century. To thank LaCrone and to honor his legacy in the tastiest of ways, the Babcock Hall Dairy Store announced its newest flavor, March on LaCrone. It's a vanilla ice cream with cranberry swirls and white chocolate flakes, and fans can get their own in Madison at the Memorial Union, Union South, and the Babcock Dairy Store on Linden Drive. And LaCrone has a longstanding tradition of stopping at that store on Linden Drive for a cone on the way to the last practice of the regular marching season. Our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, was a member of the Badger Band, and she's having some serious feelings about all of this. Sarah, what's it like?
Judith, I'm having so many emotions about this weekend. About the ice cream, I was a flugelhorn from 2012 to 2016, and I gotta say, Mike LaCrone, no one is more deserving than him to get an ice cream flavor. I will say that it is interesting that it has, you know, cranberry swirl and white chocolate flakes in it, because his favorite flavor of ice cream is straight up vanilla, and I'm sure he appreciates the ice cream. But he's a plain guy. He likes his vanilla ice cream, and I just have so many emotions about this weekend. Everyone's going to have a blast.
So this weekend is the final band concert.
It's the final one. There will be pyrotechnics. It is a big, you know, fill the Kohl Center for three nights, and it's so exciting.
Are you going to be there?
Oh, you bet.
We'll have to talk with you about it later. Stay with us here on Central Time.